Stay in contact with her, and I hope to stay in contact with Becky as well. So I want to give you Becky R. from the Highland Peace Group of Louisville, Kentucky.
I'm an addict named Becky. What happened to the rest of my podium up here? I wanted you to be able to read my shirt, so I asked them to go ahead and move the top half of the I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be clean, and I'm very grateful to be in such a beautiful place with so many beautiful people. It's been a wonderful, wonderful retreat for me. And I'm at a place in my life, as we are so often, where I'm in that place of realizing that the journey continues. Just like when we come into recovery and pick up the pieces again, and the journey continues or starts. That happens for me, and I'm sure for all of us, on a regular basis. And if we really think about it on a smaller level, on a daily basis, or maybe even a momentary basis through the day. So I love the name of the convention, and I love the idea, the theme of picking up the pieces. So thank you. Thank you, Court, for asking me to share. And thank you to the committee for having faith in my experience, strength, and hope. It's amazing to me when somebody who's heard me share asks me to come and share again. I'm not your typical speaker. I don't do a circuit. I've never listened to a taping of myself speaking. I've never mailed out a tape or MP3 or CD of myself speaking, and when somebody tells me they heard one, I just want to cringe a little bit. So thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it. I'd like for you, if you're willing, to join me just to take a moment to close your eyes and sit up straight in your chair and put your hands on your stomach. And just with me for a moment, breathe in deeply all the way down into your stomach. Hold it in for a second and then breathe out deeply. Breathe in deeply again all the way down into your stomach. And hold it in for a second and then slowly breathe out. And as you continue to breathe, just become present in your chair, in this moment, in this room, in the middle of these beautiful woods, and just realize that each of us right now is exactly where we're meant to be. And for this moment, or for this hour together, we can let everything else just kind of fall away. And I just ask you to join me in the here and now. And I thank you for that. I was told a long, long time ago by my first sponsor that when I share my story, no matter where or how, that I start off by qualifying myself so that you know that we're just alike. So my clean date is October 24th, 1986. I got clean in Louisville, Kentucky, and where I live now. And I came into these rooms through the back door with another person who was trying to get clean, but not by accident. My home group is the Highland Peace Group of Narcotics Anonymous. And the Highland Peace Group of Narcotics Anonymous is the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting that I ever attended. it's been my home group off and on whenever I've lived close by for the last 27 years. I have a difficult time. I have to count every time somebody asks me how long I've been clean, I forget. 27 years. So it's been my home group for most of that 27 years. I got clean in Alcoholics Anonymous. There wasn't any Narcotics Anonymous where I live. And I stayed clean in Alcoholics Anonymous for my first 30 days. And they welcomed me, and they loved me where I was. And they taught me their steps and traditions. And they gave me coffee and let me smoke cigarettes and all of those good things that we did in meetings. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I came from a life of where I had to hide a lot of the time who I really was. And when I came into the Alcoholics Anonymous program, I felt like I still had to hide a little bit of who I was. Because I was using a language and talking about things that didn't really include all of me. And so after about 30 days, somebody said, "Have you ever heard of Narcotics Anonymous?" and invited me to the Highland Peace Group, which was about an hour away. And I went to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I was nervous. And I sat in the back. It was a huge meeting. It was one of two meetings in the area at the time. And I sat in the back of the meeting because I didn't trust you. And because I had to see who my competition was. And because I had to make sure I was safe. So I sat in the back of the room and I judged you. I watched you and I watched how you acted and I watched what you were wearing and I watched how you interacted with other people. And I judged you because I was afraid. And then some people got up to the podium to share, and it was a meeting where several different people shared on a topic. And even though I was in the back of the room and I was really busy taking your inventory, some of the words that people were saying started to sink in. And they were saying things like, "When I got to Narcotics Anonymous, I felt completely broken. I felt completely empty. I didn't love myself. I had lost the respect of myself and everyone who knew me. I rarely smiled. I didn't feel a connection with a higher power. I felt different than everybody else." And you kept talking and you kept describing me and how I felt in that moment. And then you went on to say things like that life has gotten better. There's a woman that spoke that night who hadn't used anything in 90 days. That was amazing to me that someone had made it for 3 months without putting anything in their system. You talked about hope, you talked about family, you talked about jobs and stability, and you talked about things, concepts that were quite foreign to me, especially these concepts of self-love and self-acceptance. But I really liked the way they sounded. I knew that I wanted some of what you had, and I heard you saying that if I kept coming back, that I could have that too. And so that night in Narcotics Anonymous, I made that long walk up from the back of the building to get that my first white key tag. I still have it. It's unrecognizable. I chewed it and bent it and, you know, sucked on it and played with it and all the things that I needed to do, but I hung on to it. And it's just this wadded up piece of plastic now, this unrecognizable key tag, and it meant the world to me. And it didn't keep me clean, but it was that constant reminder that there were rooms full of people who felt like I felt and who did the horrible, indescribable, stuff, torturous things that I did, who had gotten better and who'd been able to go amazing amounts of time, like 90 days without using anything. So I hung on to it. And I found my home that night in Narcotics Anonymous. I found you, and you let me be me. And you let me talk in a language that really described my addiction, that didn't focus on a specific drug, but that realized that I had a disease, that I was an addict, and that I needed to continue to care for myself because I would always be an addict, and that I needed to continue to follow a few simple suggestions if I wanted to get better. My first sponsor was Lonnie M., and Lonnie took me on as a new sponsee, and I think I had about 90 days clean when I asked Lonnie to be my sponsor. There were two women in our area. There was a mean lady, and she became my grand sponsor, and there was a nice lady, Lonnie, who became my sponsor. And I needed a nice lady. Yeah, I did. Now I hear people say, I need a mean sponsor. I need somebody who's going to kick my ass. I need somebody who's going to keep me in line. And man, I needed someone to be nice to me. I had been so mean to me for so long. And I behaved in ways that allowed other people to be mean to me for so long. And you know what I really needed was those arms that you all put around me when I got here. That compassion that you looked at me with when I got here. And I know it wasn't easy a lot of days, because I was really nasty. I was really nasty when I got here, purposefully to keep people at a distance. I used the S word, every other word. I dressed inappropriately, I acted inappropriately, I sat in meetings and chain smoked cigarettes, and I would shake so badly because I was still going through withdrawal that my cigarettes would pop out of my hand and burn people who were sitting next to me. I spilled coffee on myself and anything I was asked to read, and sometimes the people next to me. I flirted with other people's husbands, and I flirted with other people's wives, and I did whatever I could to try to feel okay, and also, probably unconsciously, to try to keep you all at a distance. And yet, despite the way I dressed and acted and looked and smelled and burned and cursed, you asked me to keep coming back. You accepted me and you loved me until I was able to love myself. And so this kind woman, Lonnie, when I asked her to be my sponsor, she kind of had a look of shock on her face. I was laughing so hard when I heard the speaker share last night, and thank you for that beautiful message. But when he was sharing about our reaction, sometimes how it feels when that newcomer comes around, and for me it's always that woman who really reminds me of me when I got here. My first reaction, oh my God, there I am, right? Someone who looks and acts and reminds me of what addiction looks like and what I look like. And so Lonnie was leaving on a vacation to Mexico. She came from a very different world than I came from. She was very well-mannered and well-educated and well-liked and generous and kind and soft-spoken and loving and gentle. And she asked me to allow her to ponder that decision until she got back from Mexico. And I was terrified, right, because I had this mean lady, Mary, who I was going to have to ask to be my sponsor if Lonnie said no. And so maybe those were some of the first prayers that I said. I don't remember, but I do remember fretting while she was away and feeling a great sense of relief when she came back and she said she was willing to take me on as her sponsee. And she sponsored me in her gentle, kind, soft, compassionate way, and that did not mean that she didn't hold me accountable. And that did not mean that she didn't challenge me, and that didn't mean that she didn't insist that if she were going to be my sponsor, that I needed to be working a program of recovery. That's what sponsorship is about, is leading us, sharing experience, strength, and hope, and leading us and working a program of recovery. So her deal was, and my deal is, if you're not working a program of recovery, then you really don't need me as your sponsor, right? And so she held me very accountable and walked me through early recovery and then on into life. And she walked with me through my first 26 years of recovery. And 2 years and 3 days ago, she died. She died of cancer, and she suffered a lot at the end of her life. She was in a lot of pain all the time. And I had the honor, through those last several weeks of her life, of sitting with her while she was in the hospital. And a lot of times we really couldn't converse because she was in so much pain. But I would sit with her and I would tell her love stories. And I would talk to her about the legacy that she had left in recovery, of all the people's hearts who she had touched, and of all the hearts that they had touched, and all the hearts that they had touched, and this miraculous love that she had shared in recovery that had helped millions of people. And I sang her love songs, and I held her hand, and I prayed with her, and I got to give her my last drink of water, and I got to give her her last food. And I went and got an organic peach. And it was still warm. And I broke it into pieces with my fingers and fed it to her. And it felt like such an honor. And I felt like I was able to give her just a little piece of what she had given me for all those years. My current sponsor is Louise M. And Louise and I met about four years ago through a friend's death. We had a friend, Amy, who lived in Maryland, who overdosed. And Amy's husband wanted to bring some of her ashes to the area that we live to sprinkle in a place where Amy used to do sweat lodge, where she used to worship in her way. And it just so happened that I had sponsored Amy when she lived in Kentucky, and that the land where her husband Rich wanted to sprinkle her ashes, I now lived on. And so when Rich came to bring Amy's ashes and to celebrate her life with her group of friends and Narcotics Anonymous in Kentucky, he brought Louise with them. And we bonded through that tragic loss and became soulmates. And I think we had a conversation once that if anything ever happened to one of our sponsors, not knowing that we would sponsor each other. And even though Louise lost her husband very shortly before I lost Lonnie, she agreed to take me on as her sponsee. And as she grieved, she agreed to walk with me through my grief. And that's unconditional love. I know that's not easy. And I know that makes it easier. So thank you. So sponsorship for me wasn't a game. I didn't play musical sponsors. Sponsorship is where, for me, where I learned about commitment, where I learned about sticking and staying. It's where I learned about, even if the other person wasn't acting like I wanted them to act, or if they had a different opinion and I had even a vastly different opinion, or if we had an argument, or if she wasn't immediately available when I called her, that then that was time for me to rely on my support system and my higher power. It wasn't time for me to canter and go find something else, someone else. It wasn't time for me to consider myself having outgrown her and move on. It was time to learn about commitment and mature, reasonable relationship, which has taught me how to have every other relationship in my life, and I'm so grateful for those lessons on unconditional loving commitment that we learn through sponsorship. I was born into a family that was and is wrought with addiction. And I was born into my parents' marriage a little bit too late. It was already over. They were still together, but it was already over. And I learned through a dream and then asking my mom a question that I wasn't wanted by my father, that he had tried to talk her into having an abortion when I was in her stomach. And I didn't learn that until just a few years ago when I kept having this dream that my dad was asking my mom to have an abortion. And I went with her, and we had the kind of relationship where we can be honest with each other. And she told me that had really happened. And that explained a lot, because I had always had, not just with my dad, and I have three of them, and I have issues with all of them. I've got daddy issues. So it explained a lot, because I had always had this feeling of not being wanted. I had always had this feeling of not being enough, this feeling of not measuring up. I grew up in a big family, and I used to have this feeling that maybe I was adopted, that I didn't really fit in with everybody else. I never felt comfortable in my skin. And so very shortly after I was born, my mom went to Africa. I was born in England, and she and my father divorced, and she went to Africa, and she took me and my two older siblings with her. And she moved to Africa to work with a tribe of Africans called the Maasai, a warrior tribe, and she was working with them to try to help the women in their culture who were still being circumcised and were bleeding to death during pregnancy and intercourse. She wanted to help save some lives, and she took us along. And so I grew up as part of this African tribe, and I grew up nursing off of the women in the tribe because they did everything as a group, as a village. I grew up speaking Swahili. That was my first language. I grew up running with the other kids who I lived with, and I grew up thinking that I was a little African girl. And so when my mom met my second dad in Africa, he was American, and we came to the United States with him, she took me up to a mirror for the first time in my life. And I had seen my reflection in the water, and I had seen my reflection in Coca-Cola cans that the women in the tribe would sometimes use to make jewelry out of. But I had never gotten that I was a little white girl. We had bad words for those in the tribes that I grew up in. And so when my mom held me up to that mirror in the airport in New York City, I started screaming some of those words out. And I started trying to scratch this white skin off of my face so I could see myself again. And I tell you that story because I felt that same feeling. I have felt that same feeling so regularly in my life. That feeling of looking in the mirror and not being able to connect the who I was looking at with me. Feeling so distant from myself that I didn't know who that little girl in the mirror was. And funnily enough, one of the first things that my sponsor asked me to do when we started working together was a little exercise that I thought was really stupid. I was a sassy little thing. And so she said, every day I want you to look in the mirror and I want you to look yourself in the eye and I want you to tell yourself that you love yourself. And I was like, I look in the mirror all the time, so this is not going to be a problem. And gave her some kind of silly answer. And so that night, I went back to the little apartment where I live. I got married my first day clean. to another addict who was trying to stay clean. And we had all of our youthing friends at the reception and a bar. And we went on a honeymoon and they filled our room with champagne bottles. And it was it's not suggested. It's not suggested. And there's a reason. So I went and we had a wonderful life in early recovery. We lived in a little dark concrete block apartment that was above an Army recruiting station. So there was always interesting things going on below. And I would sit in that dark apartment and I would keep the shades drawn because I was afraid for my life. Now, one of the reasons was because Martin, the person who had taken me to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, had been involved in some of the things that we were doing with drugs with my husband and I. And just a couple of days after he got clean, they had taken him into a graveyard and they shot him execution style in the back of his head. And so realistically, I had some things to be afraid of. But I was also really paranoid. So I had those things to the reality of maybe I was going to get murdered in a graveyard. And I was scared of anything that moved working together. And so I would draw the shades in this dark concrete block apartment above the Army recruiting station. And I would watch videos all day long, back to back, and smoke cigarettes. I mean, smoke cigarettes like crazy, like 3, 4, 5 packs of cigarettes a day in this dark apartment. And then I would call my sponsor sometime of day that didn't seem too early. And I would have meaningful conversations like, what are you going to wear to the meeting tonight? What are you doing? You know, what meeting are you going to? What did you have for lunch today, right? But I was calling her. And then I would go to a meeting. And I would have that hour, it used to be an hour, that hour reprieve from my fear. And I didn't even realize it until later on, but for that hour a day, when I sat with you, I felt okay. And then I would go back to that dark apartment and with this man I was married to that I didn't know and smoke a bunch of cigarettes and watch videos. And so I went into that apartment after my sponsor gave me that assignment. And I'm telling you, I can remember the smell in the bathrooms and the bath I had just taken. I can remember that I had a Steve Miller Band record playing on a record player. I remember the sounds of dripping water and that music when I walked up to that bathroom mirror for the first time. And I wasn't so cocky anymore because I was alone. And I remember having a really hard time bringing my eyes up to that mirror. And I remember finally getting them up there, and I remember looking, I remember glimpsing just for a moment. It was all I had the nerve to do. I couldn't keep looking. I remember glimpsing just for a moment into my own eyes and tears running down my face. And you know, it was a really long time before I could say the words "I love you," but I kept practicing every day. And so what seemed so silly and what felt so familiar was one of the most powerful assignments in recovery that I ever had to do. Very powerful. And I want to live the kind of life that allows me to do that every day without pause, to be able to look myself in the eye for as long as I please, and to be able to express love to myself without any tears and feel it from the bottom of my heart. And most days, it comes pretty easy now. I started using when I was really, really young. When we came back to the United States, we lived in Boston, Massachusetts for a very short time. And then we moved to a hippie commune in Northern California. And part of growing up there, you know, part of being a kid was learning how to use. And so you had well-meaning adults who would blow you shotguns before your fingers worked well enough to hang on to the joint yourself. And I mean, they didn't mean us really. I really mean that they didn't mean us any harm. That these were adults in our lives who were trying to find a new spirituality and a new sense of love and openness and a lack of rules and a freedom that they desperately desired after everything that they had gone through in their lives. And there were some beautiful things about living there. I didn't have television, so I didn't see racism until I was a teenager. I didn't see sexism until I was a teenager. I saw a lot of things a kid probably shouldn't see, but I didn't see those things. And there was a deep love in the area that I grew up in, a deep sense of compassion, a deep sense of spirituality. But there was also a lot of using that went along with it, and not just using drugs, but using sex and using other people and using things, again, outside of yourself. Even spirituality, obsessive spirituality, is a way to get out from being in touch with who you really were. So there were some unhealthy things that happened to me during that time. But I remember really, really clearly the first time that I got high. And I told you a minute ago about the fact that maybe even before I was born, I had a feeling of not being wanted, and I had a feeling of not being loved, and I had a feeling of not being comfortable in my own skin. And the first time I used, all of that went away. I loved it. I loved it. I felt confident. I felt comfortable in my skin. I felt loved and accepted. I had some people I had this in common with. I loved it. It worked for me. It worked wonders for me. It was like magic. And I remember thinking, I'm going to do this anytime I get the opportunity, hopefully all the time for the rest of my life. This is the answer. This is what I want to do. And you know, for me, it worked. It worked for a while. Very well. And then, one day, and I don't really know exactly when, but I'll tell you the first couple of things I remember. My parents divorced. My mom married my third dad. He had relocated off the commune to rural Kentucky. Talk about a culture shock. I'm a little African girl, and now I'm a hippie flower child. And now I'm moving to rural Kentucky, and I'm in a Catholic school. I'm talking about little plaid skirt, shiny shoes, white-collared shirt, praying to a God whose name I've never heard. And I remember going out on a roof outside of my bedroom. And the saving grace was that my stepdad used too. So I still had some access. And I remember going out my bedroom window and sitting on the roof all alone under the stars and getting high. And getting high, and getting high, and it wasn't working anymore, right? That magic didn't come. So I'm sitting on that roof in my little plaid skirt with my white collared shirt and my shiny shoes. This had been me the year before going to school where clothing was optional. And I'm sitting on the roof, and I'm using and using and using, and it's not working. And I'm not feeling comfortable in my skin anymore. It's not making me feel loved anymore, and I'm not feeling like I fit in anymore, like I belong. I remember that when the addiction started to turn on me, and it wasn't my friend anymore. And I remember also as a teenager, around that same time, waking up in the morning and my body was shaking uncontrollably. And I remember in order to get myself to stop shaking enough to open a bottle of something I needed, I had to open a bottle of something else I needed to stop the shakes enough to open the bottle of something else I needed, and it wasn't any fun anymore. Because I had to hide what I was doing. Because you don't want your addict dad to know you're stealing the chaos that we live in, right? So I had to hide my use, and I had to use in order to function. And this is a little girl who's getting ready to get on the school bus, having to do this in order to go to school. And I wanted to go to school, and I wanted to do well in school. I loved math, you know. I loved learning. But I had to get high in order to be able to not shake enough to be able to get on the bus and go to school. And I had to keep using in order to be able to function. And it wasn't so much fun anymore. It was fun every now and then, but it wasn't really so much fun anymore. And then I remember getting to the point where I couldn't be in my parents' home anymore because I was too far gone. And I remember having to move into some people who were some of those people where I was like, if I ever get, you know, I always had those people, if I ever get where I'm that bad, then I'll, you know, no way, then I would stop. And then you'd be partying with them, and you'd be like, yeah, but see those people over there. If I ever get like that, I'm quitting, you know, and then you're using with them, right? And you're like, wow. So I remember moving in with some of those people who, if I ever used like them, I would stop. And so I was living in a house, and I was living in this little white house on top of a hill in the middle of town with no trees. I mean, it stood out like I don't know what. And so you've got these addicts who live there, my fiance, my boyfriend, my other boyfriend, right, and me, who live in this house on the hill. And everybody who drove by sees these cars coming and going and smoke coming out the window or whatever. And then we decided that we needed to do something about that, so we took cardboard boxes and we taped them over all the windows. So then I'm living in this little white house on the top of the hill with no trees around it in the middle of town with all these addicts coming and going and cardboard boxes taped around the window. And the cops driving by really slowly multiple times a day. And so somebody somewhere close got murdered, and someone in the house got a hold of some of that crime scene tape, that yellow crime scene tape. So we decided, and I'm living in this house, and I'm getting up and I'm using multiple substances to try to stay where I want to stay until I pass out, and then I'm getting up and using multiple substances, and I never knew if it was day or night. I kid you not, I never knew, because it was cardboard boxes taped over the window. So we took that crime scene tape and we decided if we wrapped that around the house, then people would think that all those cars that were coming and going were detectives or something dealing with this crime scene. This is how rational my thinking was at the time. And those other people who, if I ever got to be like them, I was going to quit. So I started overdosing regularly, not on purpose. I was suicidal, like we're all suicidal, right? Because we're on that journey of self-devastation. But I wasn't having those thoughts about wanting to hurt myself. But because I was so afraid of coming down, I would mix so many different things and so much of so many different things that I would overdose. And I would be hospitalized, and I'd come home and I'd do it again. And I remember the last time I had some using friends who came to the house and to talk me out of using the way I was using. And I had promised them I wasn't going to use a specific substance, and it was part of the regimen that I used and overdosed that night. And I remember coming to, and I was naked on this water bed, and every inch of my skin hurt. It was like my skin had been torn off. And I was laying on this water bed, and I was hallucinating, and I would hallucinate every time I threw up. There were piles of this drug, and I'd have to move to a different area. And I went in the hospital, and when I went in the hospital that time, when I came out of the coma, I remember my mom was there talking to the doctor, and here was her little girl. I was a little girl. I was 19 years old, and the doctor was saying, I don't think she's going to make it this time. And so I remember laying there in that bed, in that hospital bed, and I remember my mom's heaving sobs. And I remember feeling shame. And I remember wanting to use so I didn't have to feel shame. And I remember feeling some fear that I wasn't going to make it. And I remember wanting to use so that fear would go away. But more than anything else, I remember that there was a spark inside of me. There was something spiritual that was still alive in there, and there was a little spark inside of me that wanted to live. And so, in my own dysfunctional way, I found recovery. I had, my fiance had been coming to see me in the hospital every day, and my boyfriend had been arrested for some of the things that we were doing, and he called me. His parents got him into a treatment facility out of jail, and he called me in the hospital. I was there overdosed, and he said, "We don't ever have to use again." And here it was that day I had that little spark of hope and wanting to live, and he said, we don't ever have to use again. I'm in treatment, and I have a great idea. We can get married and stay clean together." And so I was like, "That is a great idea. Let me call my fiance, right? And let him know that he's been replaced." So I was introduced to meetings. And then I come to the point in my story where I started off of finding Narcotics Anonymous. Thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, they're not the enemy. We love them. It says so in our basic text. Not only does it say so in the basic text, but it's really early on. And if you ever read it, you'll see it. You'll be amazed. So whoever told you that we don't like them and that they're the enemy was lying. Or they were expressing their own feelings. But as a fellowship, we're grateful. And as an individual, I'm grateful. Because we used to take the big book and change the words. Because we didn't have any basic text. We used to make it work, you know, we made it work, and they supported us in that. I started my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting with 30 days clean. That first meeting I told you about where I sat in the back and I shook and I cried and I got that first key tag, and more than that, I got that first shot of hope. Somebody after that meeting, and let me tell you this, man, there were a line of people. There were a line of people waiting to talk to me after that meeting. To give me their phone numbers, to give me hugs, to give me suggestions, to get to know me. What happened? What happened? Line up. Line up when those newcomers come in. Do what you did for me, for that newcomer that's walking in tonight. Give them that shot of hope. Line up. You know what one guy did for me? He wasn't even from our area. He was from New Mexico. And he had like 3 years, which was like amazing. He had a meeting starter packet in this little VW bus outside. And he bought it into me, and he said, "Becky, go home and start a Narcotics Anonymous meeting." And he gave me that newcomer packet. And you know who supported me initially? Those old guys from the other fellowship came in there, and they were really uncomfortable. Because this was not home for them, and this was not their language, kind of like when I was over there. And they sat there, and they helped me keep the lights on and the coffee pot going until some addicts started to come in, and then they gracefully faded away. Beautiful. Beautiful support. And I don't know how many people they referred to our meeting, but it got really big, really fast. It was beautiful. It's still going. It's growing. There's more. And it's the little town that I lived in. Beautiful. And then I got Lonnie as my sponsor, and she was about like diving in, not just with that love mirror exercise, which is so amazing, but she's like, "We're going to work some stuff now." And we walked through the steps about once a year for about 26 years. And you talk about getting to know somebody inside out, you know. When you walk through 26 fourth steps and 6 steps and 7 steps and 9 steps, when you walk group, when you walk the steps with another person or a group of people, there's an incredible intimacy in that and an incredible healing, not just for the person who's writing and sharing the step, but for anyone else who's involved. Being a sponsor is an incredible honor. It's incredible. I feel amazed when somebody asks me to be their sponsor, and even more amazed if they call, because a lot of times that never happens. And then when they start sharing the steps, I mean, it's the heartbeat of our program. It's incredible. It's incredible how intimate we become with each other. How intimate, if we're real and we get involved, that we become with our home groups. Sometimes even with our areas, because we're giving ourselves to each other. It's a beautiful, beautiful program. It's magical. It's incredible, the journey that we walk on together. Just incredible. So she kept me working the steps. She told me I needed to go to a meeting every single day. And I went to a meeting every day for 5.5 years, at least once a day. And I went because I was scared not to go. I went because I didn't like it in that dark, dingy apartment that I lived in. I went because you became my social life, because I stayed away from anyone who had anything to do with addiction, even my family for a while. I went because I loved it. I went because initially that's the only place I could feel my higher power. And I remember my sponsor, and I described to you earlier the safety that I felt in a meeting that I never felt anywhere else. And I remember somebody suggesting, I don't remember if it was my sponsor or somebody else, saying, you know that you can take that with you when you go home. You don't have to leave it here. And they invited me to take that feeling of safety and spirit that I felt in the meeting with me when I walked out the door. And with their permission, I started to do that. I hadn't even realized that I could feel that way all the time. You know, and it takes some time and it takes some work. But it says in our 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. It doesn't say if you have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I've told you I like learning, right? And my sponsor said this is a basic text. It's a textbook. We're going to learn from it. It's not a coaster. It's not decorative. It's not a paraphernalia that you carry with you when you share, unless you want to. It's a textbook. It's a book to study, to learn about how we do this together. And so I was really focused on everything, especially everything that our reading said. I was really intent on listening to the readings, and I invite you all to get back into that. When you go in a meeting, instead of like, hey, how are you? Oh, my phone's ringing, or whatever. I invite you to start paying attention to the readings again. They're incredible. So I was paying attention so strongly to the readings, and especially to the steps, when I heard that that is how I was going to begin to heal. And when that 12th step, when I read it, and it said, having had a spiritual awakening, right? And then I heard you all say, there aren't any promises in this fellowship. That's in that other fellowship that, But I was like, that sounds like a promise to me. That sounds like if I do my work, this is going to happen. And I wanted someone to tell me, what I was going to get. What am I going to get out of this? And it said, having had a spiritual awakening, it said, if you work these steps, amazing things are going to happen in your life, internally, externally, spiritually, in your relationships, for me, in my employment, in my family life, in my health, in every aspect. And I wanted that, and I started trudging through the steps with Lonnie. And I love them. I love them. We stopped talking about outfits and the weather, and we started talking about feelings. And we started talking about all the things that I had done when I was using that caused me not to be able to look myself in the eye. And you know, when I told her those things, I looked her in the eye. And you know what? She looked back. She didn't avert her eyes when I talked about things that were horrendous and very sad. She looked me in the eye and she kept her heart open. And when I was finished, she gave me a hug. And I remember that unconditional love and acceptance so well. And I owe it to anyone who approaches me with any confidence. So I remember the first time that I stopped talking about outfits and the weather with her. I had done something horrible. I had truly done something horrible. I was pregnant. So I married this guy my first day clean, John T. He was clean. And then 2 months later, I got pregnant with our first child. And then about 3 months later, I came to, and I was pregnant with our first child, and I was married to this guy who I didn't know, and really I didn't like. We didn't have anything in common. And so I went through a time in that first year of recovery where I was being beaten by him. He couldn't stay clean, and I was staying clean, and it caused a lot of controversy. And so he had kicked me in the stomach one day, and I had lost that baby. And I didn't know what to do. And I was so sick that I was scared that he would leave. Not scared that he would stay and kick me in the stomach again. But I was scared that he would leave. So I called his sponsor. And his sponsor said, "Let me come over and talk to you about it. Let me walk you through this." And then he came over and we had sex. And so here I am in recovery, and I'm supposed to be living like you all are living in. From what I see, it's pretty amazing, because everybody in these rooms has their life together except me. And so how am I going to come in here where every one of you has your life completely together? And you're all sharing your gratitude for recovery and your relationship with God and hugging your spouses. And I'm going to tell you that my husband's using again, and he just beat me up and I lost our baby. So I called his sponsor and he came over and we had sex, right? This sounds far-fetched, but it's not. I promise you, there is someone in your home group who is going through unimaginable pain right now. And they're scared to tell you because you all have your lives together. And they don't. And so I remember calling Lonnie. And Lonnie, my God, if you knew this woman, she was about to leave his side. With this, I don't know what it is with me and these sponsors, right? I want to make sure that if I need to, you know, I can pick them up or something. I take them with me. So, So Lonnie was married to a president of a distillery. How funny is that? Loaded. She lived in this fancy house in this fancy neighborhood and had a little white dog she carried around under her arm, and her kids were in college, and you know, it was beautiful. And guess what happened to me today, right? And I'm going to go knock on this big, right? And she and her husband are in bed with their little white lap dog. And I'm going to tell her what just happened. And so what I knew is, I can get high, and this is the first time I've faced this dilemma. I can get high or I can get honest. And so I knocked on the door, and she invited me in, and I made it very dramatic because I was new. And I screamed and yelled, and I had makeup running down my face, and my clothes were tattered, and I was, you know, yelling and hysterical, and she invited me in, and probably pretty quickly, because I imagine her neighbors were like, what's going on at Lonnie's house now? So, and I told her everything. And I knew before I went, this was it, as far as our relationship. I knew I was going to tell her this stuff, and she was going to not have anything to do with me ever again. But I knew if I didn't tell her, I was going to get high. I didn't know where else to go or what to do. And that was the first time I came clean with another human being. And she held me. And she not only held me, but she told me some stuff about her life that looked so good on the outside, you know, and some stuff about her addiction that kind of made us a little more even. She shared some of her stuff back. And she held me and she loved me and she didn't fire me, and we started working some stuff together. This is vital that we give each other a safe place to come. And it's vital for each of us. No matter how long we've been clean, to have the willingness to share with another recovering addict whatever's going on. I haven't revisited that pain or that gratitude in a long time. Incredible pain and such deep gratitude. Because she saved my life that day, because you all saved my life the first time I walked into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and because so many days and so many different ways you all have been there for me, have saved me time and time again. I don't ever have to pick up those pieces by myself. You all pick them up with me and help me put them back together. And the journey continues. The astonishing things that happen in recovery and that come from working the steps and from being honest are so much more than we could ever imagine. There's so much more than I imagined. When I came into that first meeting, and when I looked at that woman who had 90 days clean, and she was a wreck. She said she was still prostituting because she didn't know what else to do. And she, you know, was living from house to house. And no matter what, she was staying clean. And she had 30 days clean, 90 days clean that day, that first meeting. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a prostitute who moved from house to house, or whatever I needed to be with 90 days clean, right? You get what I'm saying? I just wanted some clean time. That was it. I wanted to not have to use anymore. Whatever came with it. That's what I wanted. So I had two kids with my first husband, John T., who couldn't ever stay clean. And they're 27 and 23 now. And when they were 17 and 14, I had to tell them that their dad had overdosed and died. That was the hardest conversation to date that I've had. And he knew, and the tragic thing was, he knew Narcotics Anonymous. He came and went, but he kept making it back. Up until he died. But for some reason, it just didn't stick. And during the times he was clean, just like we see with each other, he was incredible. He was this incredible, funny, talented person, a loving person, but the disease got him. And all it took was that one day, and that one time, picking up. And it could be any of us. And so I had to tell our children, knowing that it would affect every breath they took for the rest of their lives, that their father had overdosed and died. Devastating. And if you think that when you use, that it only hurts you, you are so wrong. You're so wrong. Because I thought when I used that it only hurt me. You know, talk about selfish and self-centered. Oh my God. You know, and here's my mom. I told you about her coming to the hospital, and my mom is my guru. I mean, she is amazing. This amazing person. And she would come to the hospital when I would overdose and sit and hold my hand. And my siblings, who had to know I was in the hospital again, who I used around sometimes when they saw the devastation of my addiction front and center. And for me to think that I didn't hurt them, for me to think that other addict who was using in our house and fell to the floor because he was overdosing and he thought his heart was going to explode, and I told him he needed to get out of there because the police were going to come, and I sent him off in the snow, and to think that my using only hurt myself. He didn't die that night, but he died another night when a similar thing happened and he got hit by a car. You know, everything I did hurt other people. Everything I did when I was using hurt other people. It hurt anybody who loved me. It hurt some people who didn't love me. It hurt most of the people I came in contact with. But just like that, when we begin to live a joy-filled life, when we begin to work the steps, when we begin to reap the benefits of recovery, when that spiritual awakening happens, and if you work the steps, it happens, then everybody who loves us reaps the benefits of that as well. And everybody we come in contact with, and that we work with, and that we play with, and that we're in relationship with, reaps the benefits of us taking the time and energy to work on ourselves. And life for me has become something incredible. I had the opportunity to marry another addict who does stay clean after a lot of years on my own. And I had two more babies. I had another little boy and little girl. So I have my big ones and my little ones. And they're 8 and 6 now, and they're incredible. And they've never seen us use. None of my kids have ever seen me use. And our life is amazing. Right now, I work for a group of nuns. group of nuns. So here's this little African hippie kid, drug addict, you know, overdosing, and I'm working for this, I do fundraising, so I'm doing a capital campaign for a group of nuns, and they're amazing. And they know how weird I am. They know I'm an addict. Guess what? Some of them are too. And they felt comfortable sharing that with me. We got to move into the woods a few years ago. Kind of like here. We lived out in the middle of the woods. Not what everybody wants, but it's what we wanted. And we live in the woods, and we try to treat the earth like we want other people to treat us, like we want it to treat us, keep giving back. We try to eat foods that are going to not harm us and not harm other creatures. We try to share love. We try to not only have love in our house, but we try to live the kind of life where we hope that the love we experience in there is going to seep out, right? Out of our house, just like it does out of meetings, and it starts to infiltrate other people in their homes. And the love that we share and the spirit that we feel in the meetings, just like somebody told me a long time ago, we can take that with us wherever we go. And it's incredible, because when we close the meeting, I believe, when we close the meeting with that big circle and we say a prayer together, or when we lay down in my home to go to bed at night and we express love to each other and love to our higher power, that's infiltrating everything, that it's moving out into the world and it's making positive things happen. I did not get clean to be miserable.
Yeah.
And I know, and I need to let you know, that I felt some deep emotion up here tonight. And that I shed some tears, and that I shared some pain. But I want you to know that I'm sometimes annoyingly happy and positive, I hear. Because I got clean to celebrate. And I love life. I love recovery. I love service work. I can have fun in an area service meeting. I don't go in there to start fights and have battles. And when other people do, it's kind of sad, kind of funny. But I'm going to have a good time. And I'm going to go in there and I'm going to serve with joy and selflessness. And if I'm not, I don't need to be there, you know. Service is about thank you for saving my life and everything that you've given me. And I'm so full of that gratitude and joy for what you've done for me that I want to give some of it back. That's what service is about. It is an honor, people. When I fed my sponsor that last piece that she ever ate, that was an honor. That was me giving back a little bit of what she's given to me. And if I chair a meeting, or if I chair an area service meeting, or if I chair a convention or a retreat, whatever it is I'm doing to give back to Narcotics Anonymous, I need to do it with the same care and tenderness, gratitude and joy that I felt when I gave my sponsor that last bite of food that she would ever eat. I want you to know how grateful I am to you, and that service. I want my higher power to know that I am filled with joy and gratitude for the life that I've been given, and I want to do something to help another person have that opportunity. And that's what service is about. Service through sponsorship, or service through giving back, or through speaking, not my favorite kind of service, vulnerable feeling, but still service. And that's what Lonnie taught me. She said, you don't, and Louise teaches me, these goddesses of service, that we owe it to Narcotics Anonymous to give back, but not to give back with grumbling hostility, like we see sometimes, but to give back with incredible gratitude and open hearts. Because that's what you gave me. You didn't walk up to me as a newcomer and say, grumbling nasty things. Although I might have felt more at home if you had, because of the way I've been living and treating myself, you approached me with tenderness and love. And that's the way that I try to live. That's the way that we try to live in everything that we do. If we're eating soup, we try to eat soup with tenderness and love. And if we're chairing a meeting, we try to chair a meeting with tenderness and love. And we learn to carry that, those spiritual principles that we learn in here, into every aspect of our lives. Life is to be celebrated. We all almost lost it. Like John T., we were all only an arm's length away from overdosing. And I heard someone say, we are the chosen ones earlier today. That was very impactful. It's very true. We are very blessed, whether it's your first day or your 40th year. We are very blessed to be chosen to live this life. And I encourage you, and I challenge you, to celebrate that miracle, not just here at this retreat, but with every breath that you take. Whether you're happy or sad, whether you're having a good day or a bad day, remember to breathe, remember to celebrate that miracle of life and breath that we've been given. It's an incredible gift. Narcotics Anonymous is an incredible gift. It's the best present that we'll ever get. And I'm so grateful that you were here for me when I came. And I'm so grateful that you embraced me and gave me love. And I'm so grateful that you held me accountable. And you taught me about commitment. And you told me to keep coming back. And I'm so grateful that you told me if I didn't work the steps, I was going to die. And that I needed to stay away from people that I used with. I'm so grateful that you told me that I needed to start taking care of myself. And it was okay to wear skirts that my butt cheeks didn't hang out of, right? And you told me it was okay to start carrying myself with some pride and confidence. And you told me it was okay to look in the mirror and cry. And that in time, I would be able to look myself in the eye again. And until then, that you would stand beside me. So thank you for my recovery and for every breath I take in this new life.